In today's episode, the scandal of faulty medical implants linked to the deaths of more than 1,000 people in the UK. And following the caravan, The Guardian's Brian Mealer on the migrants trying to reach America.
I'm one of these mums that let kids be kids and, you know, let them enjoy. And, you know, they still remember things like that where, you know, mum's running around with them, going on the swings with them at the park and chasing them around, going down slides with them. I had Esau put in 2013, 3 months after I had my last child. And within those 5.5 years, my life has declined to the point that I'm now in a wheelchair 75% of the time. My quality of life has drastically changed, and things will never be the same again.
It was a contraceptive implant that Laura says ruined her life. A 6-month investigation by The Guardian has found that she is one of over 1 million people from across the world with problems linked to medical devices. There have been pacemakers that ran out of battery, hernia mesh getting entangled with nerves, spinal disc replacements disintegrating. It's a serious issue here in the UK, where over 1,000 people have died. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, untested and unsafe, the scandal of faulty medical implants.
So during the past decade, there have been a few big stories around medical implants.
Hannah Devlin is The Guardian's science correspondent.
There was the story about PIP breast implants, where there was a French manufacturer that had been selling dodgy industrial silicone implants.
Health officials in Germany and the Czech Republic are advising women who've had potentially defective implants to have them removed. France and Venezuela have already said the implants made by the French company PIP should be routinely taken out.
There was a certain brand of hip replacement that contained metal that was leaching into the bloodstream.
Here we go again. First it was breasts, now implants routinely used by the NHS for hip replacement, maybe leaking metal fragments into their hosts.
And then there have been lots of problems in the last few years with vaginal mesh.
Vaginal mesh, a synthetic tape made out of plastic, used to treat urinary incontinence for decades. Now there are growing calls to stop.
We felt that each of these stories had been treated as a one-off failure. But we started to wonder whether there was something bigger going on, whether there was something wrong with the entire system.
So millions of people globally rely on medical implants. Were you able to put a number on how many have been harmed?
So there's very little publicly available about the number of problems that people are experiencing with implants. But through a series of Freedom of Information requests, we did get some data. So one of the things we found was that one of the UK health regulators receives a complaint about a medical device, the equivalent of every half an hour over the past 3 years. So that's about 62,000 complaints in total, including more than 1,000 deaths. The regulator themselves say there's a really big problem with underreporting. So, I mean, we can only guess what the real figure might be. But trying to drill down further and get information about exactly which brands these complaints are related to and which specific implants are the worst offenders is really hard. And all of the requests we put in about particular brands, like Esau, for example, were turned down on the basis of commercial confidentiality.
One of the devices that Hannah looked into was a pacemaker called NanoStim.
Now, they brought it onto the market after trying it out in 33 patients and following them up for 3 months. We heard from the first UK patient to have this device. She did a lot of media at the time where she said how much better she was feeling and how happy she was to have been chosen to be the first patient.
I was so pleased to be getting it done. I was feeling so awful. I just thought, well, the quicker I get it done, the better. And when I found out you didn't have to have a scar, it was more... jumped in it.
After such a quick recovery, Maureen will be going back home with her husband Rod, and for the first time in years.
But 3 years down the line, she started suffering palpitations and feeling really exhausted, and it turned out that the battery had gone flat on this new pacemaker, which was supposed to last for 10 years.
Do we know that it wasn't a one-off problem?
Yeah, so it turned out that this lady, Maureen, was one of dozens of people who suffered the adverse effects of this battery flaw. She said that she did receive a letter notifying her that there'd been some battery issues, but at that point she'd
had... Some battery issues? I mean, this is in her heart.
So, yeah, at that point she'd had it in already for a couple of years, and so just assumed that it wasn't really a problem for her. But then several months down the line she started getting these symptoms, and when she went into hospital it turned out that the pacemaker had died inside her.
So what other issues did you uncover?
So one of the other things we looked at was hernia mesh. We interviewed an Olympic athlete called Di Green.
The 400 metre hurdles final. Di Green and Rhys Williams right in the middle. It's Green to rise first.
He captained the London 2012 athletics squad for the Olympics, so he was really incredibly fit, obviously.
Wales have a champion. And what a champion. What a battle.
After the Olympics, he started suffering from a very small hernia, and he had a hernia repair using mesh. But once he went back into training, he started getting severe pain. And he's, you know, surrounded by the best possible medical care you can imagine. And they suggested at first that perhaps it's just still the hernia is kind of niggling him. And so he had more surgery, and that didn't resolve the problem. And then eventually, a year or two down the line, he ended up having to undergo several operations to take the mesh out again. And it turned out that it had become sort of mangled up with his nerves.
It's been a slow process back since then. And every couple of months, I feel a bit better than I did in the months before. I felt, you know, 6-7 months ago, I was definitely back on the cards.
Di's experience with hernia mesh does seem to mirror the experience of lots of other people who've had this surgery. And there are now big lawsuits going on in the US and Canada and Australia where people are taking the manufacturers of this kind of mesh to court.
And I know you also looked into eShore, which is a device inserted into the fallopian tube for permanent birth control.
So before eShore was brought onto the market, there was actually quite a big trial looking at how it worked in more than 500 women, which reported really high satisfaction rates. I think 97% of women said they were happy with it. They were followed up for 5 years. And initially, when it came onto the market, it seemed very popular. A gynaecologist I spoke to in the Netherlands, who's done thousands of these procedures, said initially he had a really positive impression. He was getting loads of requests from people who'd been recommended it by friends and relatives.
We spoke to a woman called Laura about her experience of eShore. She was the busy mother of five who we heard from at the beginning of the piece. She went to the gynaecologist after giving birth to her youngest child.
I had him in July and I went to my doctor because I've always had really, really horrendous periods. And I described to them my issues and I said, you know, well, I don't want any more children, so you might as well take it all out if you have to, you know. And she offered me eShore.
What if I got pregnant again? What would we do? Everything would change.
Had you ever heard of eShore before?
No, I'd never even heard of it before I stepped in that room.
Do you ever worry about unplanned pregnancy? Now there's a way to push away those worries with eShore.
Sure, honey, let's go. And
free yourself. So I've gone in to have the procedure, and she started putting the eShore in my left tube. And I can remember getting very faint, at times almost passing out, screaming into the gas and air tube that I had in my mouth, sucking it in as long and hard as I could, and it just wasn't bringing any relief, and it just wasn't stopping. And I wanted to ask her to stop. I wanted to stop her doing what she was before. No, you know, you need to get through this. You need to be, you know, the doctor knows what she's doing. If this was, it just felt wrong. It didn't feel right. I felt completely violated. So as time's gone on, I've been starting to get quite unwell. My hair started falling out and my periods were, if anything, worse than before. I was getting other symptoms, you know, with a funny taste in my mouth, rashes. My tummy kept on bloating out. I just got sicker and sicker and just more tired. My relationship with my son's father broke down. We broke up. The person I was before was slowly disappearing before my eyes. Things just gradually got worse and worse and worse to the point that, you know, I was ending up in hospital all the time, and I just wasn't at home with my children, and they're having to spend more time with their dad. I'm obviously in such a mess, you know, I've got no option but to say, yeah, take them, because I'm not being a very good mum right now. I'm too sick, and maybe, you know, their needs would be better met if they weren't with me. Probably in early 2015, it got to the point where ambulances were being called because I was in that much pain, and they'd come in and they'd give me the gas and air and they'd give me morphine, and at some points I'd be going to hospital and they'd be giving me fentanyl, and they just couldn't find anything wrong with me, and they started suggesting that it was in my head and I was drug seeking and attention seeking, and it just felt like they didn't believe me.
When did you realise that Eshaw was the problem?
I'd started having symptoms pretty much as soon as I had it put in, but I didn't put two and two together. I mean, I just had a baby, and your body changes when you have a baby, and, you know, I thought, oh, maybe it's all hormonal, all these things going on, and it wasn't until I was online and I came across the American Eshaw Problems page, and suddenly it was like a light bulb had gone off in my head. So on one of the times I'd gone into hospital, they sent me through to gynaecology, and the gynaecologist hadn't even heard of Eshaw. I was the one that was telling him, oh, you know, go look up this doctor in America, go look up this page, and giving him all of the websites to go and look at. And it was like, finally, a doctor had listened to me. This gynaecologist booked me in for removal, and I said, oh, it's got to be done this way, you've got to be careful, don't fragment. He's like, yeah, I know what I'm doing. Unfortunately, when he did the procedure, because it's the first one he'd done, it was his first removal, the Eshaw devices did fragment, and I was left with some parts of it behind. But immediately after the procedure, I did feel absolutely loads better, and I did still have pain, but not in the same way that I had pain. But unfortunately, if you've got a fragment of Eshaw left inside of you, it can be as bad as having the whole of Eshaw inside of you. My health isn't the greatest now. My mobility has declined. I use a wheelchair probably about 75% of the time. If I'm out, I use a walking stick. I can potter around a small distance, but anything more than 10 metres is unbearable.
God, and then you've got 5 kids.
My kids have got so used to seeing mummy poorly, it's just normal to them now. This isn't the life that when I decided to have each of them that I wanted them to have. This wasn't the mum I wanted to be, that my 17-year-old is, on the days where I can't get out of bed, he's given me a cup of tea through a straw and a cup because I'm too weak to move. That when I need the toilet, he's helping me get out of bed and use a walking frame and more or less carrying me to the toilet and helping me pull my trousers down and closing the door while I go to the toilet, then helping me back to bed again. Or when I collapse on the floor, he's helping me up. He's 17, he should be out of his friends. He's 18 soon. Instead of being the caregiver, I'm now the one being cared for.
What happened to Laura is terrifying. Hannah, did you come across other cases like this?
In the past few years, there's been growing concern about the number of people coming forward with complications. In the US alone, the regulator has recorded more than 26,000 adverse incident reports linked to Eshaw.
And earlier you mentioned a Dutch gynaecologist who felt quite positive about the device. What did he say?
So the gynaecologist said that over the past few years, he's had more and more women coming to him with problems as well. And he's now done nearly 500 removals of the Eshaw implants, which were designed to be permanent. He told me that he was starting to be convinced that there was a real problem. He described a lot of women coming with pain, but then also sometimes other symptoms like hair loss or teeth falling out.
Teeth falling out?
Yeah, or other just not really feeling like themselves or not feeling well.
So one thing that people can do, which we know Laura did, is file a complaint with the UK regulator, the MHRA.
one of the things that really alarmed us when we started looking at our own regulator, the MHRA, was what happens when they get these reports. And we found that over the past 10 years, during which time the number of reports they were getting in had doubled, there'd been a complete collapse in the number of investigations that they carried out with one of their specialists. So 10 years ago, they used to do about a third of the report complaints that they got, they would do a specialist investigation. But last year, that had dropped to just 1%.
Do you think it's a systemic problem?
Look, a lot of people have benefited from medical devices. There's a huge number of devices on the market that, you know, have saved lives, that have transformed people's lives for the better. But we also found a lot of things that really worried us, right from the way devices are brought onto the market in the first place, often without trials, the lack of transparency around trying to find information about the number of complications that people suffer, so the way patients are not listened to when they have problems.
And you mentioned people not being listened to. That was definitely something we heard from Laura, the idea that when she went to the doctors, they even believed that she was just trying to get drugs and they were just not convinced by her symptoms. Is that the type of thing you heard from lots of people?
Yeah, it's so striking that, you know, having heard from dozens of people now with a whole range of different implants, it's something that we've heard so many times, that people just aren't really listened to and not trusted to, you know what's going on with their own body. And, you know, I've heard from people being kind of told, oh, maybe it's, you know, psychological problems that, you know, making you feel this way, or, you know, it's almost a problem with you rather than a problem with the implant.
And people get a lot of help and support from other sufferers.
Yeah, that's something that's really noticeable as well. There's been a huge growth in sort of online patient forums and support groups and campaign groups that have allowed these patients who may have once just thought they were a unique example, it's really brought them together.
I mean, we've got this little chat on Facebook Messenger and we talk every day together. You know, we are really strong, we're quite united. We went off to Parliament together and we helped the women together, and, you know, I've actually physically been to hospital with women, and Jan writes letters all the time for women, and Alison does a website, and Charlie's there, she's always there talking to people, and Mish and Sarah, and, you know, talking to the people on the page. There's always somebody there when someone needs it. The other ladies on the page and I, we were meeting up for the weekend. We just came up with the idea that we'd all get a tattoo together, the same tattoo. And I've got mine on my collarbone and they've got theirs on their arm.
What is it?
It's a phoenix flying across and it's got E-Sisters written on it with a heart. And I don't know where I'd be without them. And I don't know, it sounds horrible, I don't know whether I'd still be here.
Baya, the producer of eSure, said patient safety was its highest priority and that this product had undergone significant clinical trials. They added, quote, "We continue to stand behind the product's safety and efficacy, which are demonstrated by an extensive body of research undertaken by Baya and independent medical researchers." Abbott, who make the Nanostim pacemaker, said many patients had already been helped by this technology and many more would be. It said it had been approved based on strong performance and safety data, including a follow-up study on the device after its approval. The MHRA said the reports via its online reporting system did not always mean a fault with the device. A spokesperson said, "Our highest priority is making sure the medical devices available in the UK work and are acceptably safe." To read all the reporting from Hannah and The Guardian's Hilary Osborne and Kaylin Barr, buy the paper and go to the website. They were among more than 250 journalists from 59 media organisations across the world who worked together to lift the lid on this scandal. After the break, the migrants attempting the journey from Central America to the United States border. Now, Donald Trump has described it as an invasion. The Guardian's Brian Mealer travels with the migrant caravan headed up to the US border to give the real story.
I met the migrant caravan in the southern state of Oaxaca on October 26th. There's tons of people, about 4,000 to 7,000 people. At the time, they had been traveling about 2 weeks and had covered about 600 miles. People that I interviewed, you know, they were farmers, and once their crops started to fail, they moved to this town where they were harassed by the gangs and beaten and extorted. You know, extortion is a really big tactic of the gangs, and if you can't pay, you're killed. So you have people fleeing the farms into the cities, and the cities are dangerous, and so they're out of options. They come north. Walking with the caravan in the early morning, you have children who are asleep in these strollers, children asleep in their parents' arms, young men, single men, just walking in silence. Everybody's really tired. And I would often ask the people, so what are you thinking about right now? And they're thinking about, well, what I left behind, what's going forward, is this stroller going to work? Am I going to have enough food? Or do we have enough water with us right now? The sun's going to be up. And they're always worried about the sun. There comes a point where the sun does come up and people get restless, they get hot, and that's when they try to jump on the trucks. At that moment, it gets very chaotic because they'll bottleneck up at these roads with these trucks stopped. And it's that kind of do or die moment. You either kind of thrust yourself into the mob to get on one of these trucks, or you walk. And so the caravan is not for the faint of heart. You know, you have to really put yourself in there. I would see these parents and these fathers, they're tired, and they would see this truck, and you know that they didn't want to run for that truck. And I just felt for these guys. I just felt for them. As a father, I just, God, man, you know, what would it be like to be here with my kids, trying to get somewhere that I had no idea what was going to happen when we got there? They would usually ask me, they'd say, well, you're an American. What's going to happen to me when I get there? And I couldn't lie to them. I had to say, well, you know, the family separation policy, do you know that when you get there, if you try to cross illegally, you'll be put in jail? The percentage of people who get asylum after their credible fear interviews is very small. But then I would just kind of see their faces and I would say, you know, but I don't know, maybe it won't be that way with you. And they go, yeah, God is with us. And I say, yes, God is with you. I remember I was interviewing a woman about, you know, why are you showing these people so much kindness? And it was one of these women who were organizing all the food and the drinking water for this one particular town. And I said, why are you guys so generous to these people? You know, and she said, well, because it's our right to move across borders. It's our right to move for our children and our families, to give them a better life. And besides, you know, here in Mexico, we know so many people who've gone north, and we've all been in that position. And it was really strange. It was that moment I get a text from a friend of mine that said, Trump has just put over 5,000 troops on the border. Troops with an M4 rifle. That's a rifle for every migrant that's on this caravan. And they're waiting behind concertina wire for some kind of invasion that they think is going to happen. I've never reported anything in my career that's been this contentious. When I was following this caravan, we started setting out about 4 or 5 o'clock, early morning, and I'm walking with these people, and it's quiet. And there's big sunflowers on the side of the road. They're like over our heads, and the mountains in Oaxaca are like all around us. It's absolutely gorgeous. The sun starts coming up, and I'm just walking with all these people, and it's very silent. And this group of men pass me, and they have this grubby backpacks with the bedroll on the bottom. It looks like three brothers, maybe. One of them has a plastic bag with a loaf of bread kind of poked into his pocket. And I had just this massive revelation. I said, this is my grandparents. These are my grandparents and my uncles. You know, in 1931, when the Great Depression hit the United States, my family were dry land cotton farmers in West Texas. And they were devastated. Their fields dry up and blew away. They had no money. They had nothing. And so my grandpa, my great-grandfather, my uncle, joined. Over 1 million people jump in the trains going west. California was where there were orchards and economic prosperity, lots of farms and work. And so Americans, they went there by the thousands, you know, from Oklahoma and Texas. And when they got on these trains, they were beaten up by the railroad police. My grandfather was actually thrown from a moving train, barely lived. And they get to the border of California, and they're met with police and riot gear. They're met with resentment and hostility. They don't want them there. And so it all just kind of came to me when I was on that road with those guys. We've all been on our own migrant roads, and that parallel, I don't think as Americans we're seeing it at all. All Americans have to do is go back a couple of generations, and they've been a migrant too.
That's all we have time for today. My thanks to Laura, Hannah Devlin and Brian Mueller. Today's episode was produced by Brenna Daldorf, Elizabeth Casson and David Waters. Sound design was by Axel Cocoutier. The executives were Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. See you tomorrow.